This is The Real Dirt, sponsored by Bickle Consulting, leading the way in modern cannabis business. BickleConsulting.com. This episode of The Real Dirt is sponsored by Cannacraft, leading the way in cannabis science, California. Well, here we are with another episode of The Real Dirt with Chip Baker. On today's Dirt, we have Jordan Wellington from Fresente Cederberg, one of the leading law offices in the cannabis industry. Say hello, Jordan.
Hey, everybody out there in podcast land.
Me and Jordan are longtime friends. We've done a lot of research together on the industry. He's helped me really gain some focus and understanding on the legal environment throughout the U.S. and specifically in Colorado. Why don't you introduce yourself, Jordan?
Hey, everybody. So my name is Jordan Wellington. I am an attorney with the law firm Vicente Cederberg, as Chip said. I focus most of my work there on cannabis regulatory policy. And what that means in more layman's terms is that I really spend my days teaching cannabis businesses how to operate in a compliant fashion, and spend the rest of my time teaching policymakers from really across the globe on how you regulate cannabis in a responsible manner.
Since we've been friends, I've seen you go everywhere. You were just recently in Alaska. You've been to numerous countries or have advised numerous countries. Were you in Puerto Rico recently?
I wasn't physically in Puerto Rico, but I have been talking to the folks that are working on regulations there.
Right. People from all over the world and country call you for advice on cannabis regulation, how to write the laws, how to understand the laws, how to manipulate the laws. Is that what you do?
Not necessarily manipulate the laws. We'll leave that to the people who kind of come in after the fact and work with businesses. A lot of my work these days focuses on working with either legislators, senators, or representatives from other states or elected officials from other countries, and then the regulatory agencies themselves. The Marijuana Enforcement Division here in Colorado, the Department of Food and Agriculture in California, for example. And I meet with those folks and really talk to them about what we've seen in terms of best practices, both here in Colorado and developing really across the globe, on how you create an effective regulatory structure, on what things do work, what things don't work, what are the things that have tripped us up here in Colorado, and how we've kind of addressed some of the bumps in the road that we've seen as we've tried to bring cannabis legalization into a 21st century economy.
You know, one of the things that really impressed me about Colorado is how fast everything happened here. Legal medical cannabis started in 1997 in California, and for 10 years, literally, there was litigation over there that wouldn't make it legal. But in just really a short period of time, Colorado seemed to put it through the legislative process, vote it into law, decide how they were going to regulate it, create the rules, and make it really effective. Colorado is really the only effective economy in cannabis right now. I know it's going on in Oregon and Washington. Let's go over a brief history of how it happened here.
Sure. Well, we're seeing things improve in Washington, and things are just starting. But for sure, at this point, Colorado is really the best functioning and most mature market for cannabis. It's interesting. California and Colorado are very divergent right now. But if you're actually to look back historically, there are a lot of similar things that have occurred. And really, the biggest differences are kind of just a couple of flashpoints. So California moved forward in 1996 with a constitutional amendment protecting medical cannabis patients. Colorado moved forward in 2000, actually, with a constitutional amendment protecting medical cannabis patients. And both operated under this caregiver model, where you would actually see these people cultivating at home and then selling to patients. It was not a storefront model like we're used to today. That continued really through the Bush administration, through the 2008 election. And shortly after Obama was in office, there were a variety of memorandums and policy documents issued by the Department of Justice that, without getting necessarily too deep into the weeds, basically said that this was not a prosecutorial priority.
Right.
And when that happened,
That was really early 2000s.
That was really like 2008, 2009.
Okay, so it went on for a number of years, just like California did.
Just like California. Right. Very, very, very much like California. And then very much like California as well, once Obama got into the office, we started to see the commercialization of the industry in a different way. We started to see these storefronts pop up. And that's a lot of the enforcement action that's still going on in California today and in Colorado as well. In fact, Andrew Livingston, who's an economist and researcher at Vicente Cederberg, likes to talk about these states together as market-driven states where the market came along before regulation did.
Sure, right. Colorado and California.
Colorado and California, yeah, right. Exactly.
Two big cannabis-producing states for years.
For years and years and years. But those states actually had a market, not just an illegal market, but storefronts before regulation came in.
Right.
And that's a huge, huge thing, because what happened in both states is you had these storefronts come out. And this is where the stories really diverge, I think, because in California, you saw some local regulation, some attempts at local regulation, but quite frankly, a failure at the state level to ever regulate.
Right.
Up until really this past summer.
They looked the other way for years.
Forever. Colorado was a different situation. Colorado, there was some local regulation, but then in 2010, during the legislative session, it was a really historic and landmark moment. And this is when things completely changed. House Bill 1284 was passed, and that regulated the industry for the first time. It was an actual state regulatory structure, licensing, background checks, inventory management, operational guidelines, the basics, the very elementary basics of what we know today as the Colorado regulatory structure were put into place during this historic time when this bill was passed. That's really where things, I mean, amongst other areas, where things really diverge in terms of Colorado and California. And this moment was critical because this led to legalization. The general public became much more accustomed to regulated cannabis and storefronts and seeing the regulated model function, which paved the way to legalization.
When did you come to Colorado?
I moved here in July of 2012.
2012. So the movement had already started to happen here, right? 2010. That's when dispensaries became regulated and legal. And you come here in 2012, start to work with the local environment. What brought you here?
I actually have family here. Okay. My stepbrother, Josh Pollock, owns Rosenberg's Bagels.
Plug best bagels
best bagels
in Denver.
Really, I would say, in the entire country outside of the New York City area.
East of the Mississippi, I think that could be a completely reasonable statement.
The point is he has fantastic bagels. And so I had some family out here. My wife and I were just simply disillusioned with life on the East Coast and quit our jobs. I was working for the Office of Legislative Services in New Jersey doing bill drafting and research. And we just kind of quit our jobs and ran away.
Right. You came to Colorado to be in part of the cannabis industry, though, specifically.
No, absolutely not.
Really?
I came to Colorado to work in politics. I had been working in economic development, renewable energy, transportation, those kinds of things, really kind of fundamental, really economic oriented areas of public policy in New Jersey. And what ended up happening was I just didn't want to live there anymore. And so I moved out to Colorado. I was obviously aware the election was happening, but it was really interested in just trying to create a better life for my family. And so I actually ended up falling completely backwards into all of this.
Right. But you came from a public policy place, which it's hard for people to believe that cannabis was going to enter this type of political atmosphere. Such a backroom situation. So you get here in Colorado, semi-legal cannabis, and you go to work for Vicente Cederberg.
No. That
was
actually quite farther down the story, but it's a very interesting story. So I moved out to Colorado in 2012, and the election was going on.
Okay.
The second Obama election. And I did what everybody who moves to a new area that wants to work in public policy and politics does, is I got volunteer jobs on campaigns. I knocked on doors. I volunteered on congressional campaigns. I did anything and everything I could for free and up to $10 an hour. I was really raking in it at the time, doing everything I could to just develop my connections and most importantly, not have to move back to New Jersey. That was really the primary
motive. Yeah, after you move here, it's hard to move back.
Yeah, the notion that we would ever have to leave was not something that we were keen on. So I ended up getting a job as an aide in the House Majority Office in the General Assembly with some folks that I know and had met met through all of this volunteer work that I did. And I was actually essentially a $400 a week aide. I did not get paid for overtime, and I worked quite a bit of it. But it was volunteer work, and I love public policy. So it was a really tremendous opportunity.
So you got to know a lot of people in the network.
I did. And I was working on gun control legislation, civil unions legislation. A lot of people don't realize Colorado didn't have civil unions until 2012. So I got to work on some very, very interesting areas of public policy. And then the governor's task force report passed. And so I guess for those who don't know the basic story of legalization in Colorado, Amendment 64 was a ballot initiative that passed in November of 2012 and basically was the impetus behind the legalization structure that we have here. It forced the legislature to kind of move forward with regulations of cannabis for the first time. And that was a truly historic campaign. And it was actually run by a lot of the folks I work with now at Vicente Cederberg, as well as Mason Tevert and Steve Fox, who are some of the originators of the safer messaging, which is a critical component in Colorado's evolution that we can kind of get to maybe down the line.
Yeah, I hope to get those guys on the show in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that what they did for cannabis and change it into a new paradigm. You know, a lot of drug policy reform is, you know, people shouldn't go to jail for cannabis, social justice reform, and that stuff is absolutely important. But it falls short in certain ways, where it says cannabis is bad, but not bad enough that people should go to jail. What SAFER says is it flips that on its head and says cannabis is safer than alcohol. Why are we making these people criminals? It doesn't come from a place of cannabis is bad. It starts with cannabis is safer. And so I think that was really important.
Yeah, that was an incredible way to change people's mentalities on it. That's really what needed to happen first.
Absolutely.
Mentality changed.
Yeah. And so when you had that mentality change, you have this passage of this ballot initiative in 2012. And what happens is Governor Hickenlooper at that time creates really what was the first cannabis regulatory working group in Colorado, the governor's task force. Christian Cederberg, one of the founding partners of the firm, was on the task force along with people really from all over the place. So they put together this giant 160 plus page report talking about the ways in which Colorado was going to implement legalization. That report was finalized at around the end of February, I would say, early March of 2012. And it came to the legislature, and it became the legislature's job to implement legalization. And this is the part of the story where I actually join in. You know, up until this point, it had been a lot of other people that I now get to work with that have kind of been handling all of this and doing this for many years. A lot of them, people like Brian Vicente, who had been working on this for eight years or something like that before even legalization. And so this report goes to the legislature, and the legislature created something that was called the Joint Select Committee, joint between the House and the Senate, not a joint that you would smoke. And
the same type.
Well,
they shared it among each other.
They did share the responsibility amongst each other, but unfortunately, there was not cannabis passed amongst them, at least to my knowledge. And so these legislators go through the entire task force report and come up with their recommendations about whether these things that the task force said that they thought were a good idea, did the legislature agree, and should they be put into a bill? Should they be amended slightly, or should they be removed entirely? And I will never forget the day. It changed my life forever. Ian Silveri, who's a good friend of mine and now is actually has left public service, but he was the legislative director at the time for Mark Ferrandino, the Speaker of the House. And he called me into his office and explained what was going on with the task force report. And I had read about it in the Denver Post. And he said, okay. He's like, good. He's like, well, you're going to be in charge of this now. He's like, you're going to be the staffer that's assigned to staff the Joint Select Committee. I'm going to introduce you to Dan Pabon, the Assistant Majority Leader, who was really kind of the point person at the legislature at the time for this kind of issue. And I was going to go work with them. And I actually very foolishly begged and pleaded with my friend to go do something else. I think I specifically stated we had a bill that's going to give 200,000 people in the state health care. Is there something else I can work on? After a series of four-letter words, and we're both from New Jersey, so that's a lot of our communication, he proceeded to tell me that this was not a democracy, although we were literally in the state capitol at the time, and that I was going to go do what he told me to do. And I was a $400 a week aide, and he was a legislative director. So I did exactly what he told me to do, and ended up not only getting to staff the Joint Select Committee and really was the sole staffer from the legislature assigned it. There was no one from, Senate majority or Senate minority or House minority. So it was really just me kind of handling everything. I not only ended up getting to work on that, but I carried the bills created from that Joint Select Committee, House Bill 1317, House Bill 1318, and Senate Bill 283 through both the House and the Senate. I wasn't even a staffer in the Senate, but when the big regulatory bills and tax bills had moved over there, they kind of drafted me onto their team, and I moved over to the Senate and worked on getting those bills passed. And so I ended up, without even realizing it at the time, getting essentially a front row seat and getting to really roll up my sleeves and get my hands dirty a little bit on how the Colorado General Assembly implemented legalization. And we got those bills passed. And I actually, this is one of my favorite stories. I always tell policy nerds, most people don't understand what this means. So unless you actually work at a legislative office or have worked, this probably won't matter to you. But we got all three bills implementing the legalization of cannabis through the Colorado General Assembly in 12 working days. Which is unheard of.
Absolutely.
Even more importantly than that, we didn't go to conference committee, which almost every single major piece of legislation goes to a conference committee, right? The House passes one version, the Senate passes another version, and then they go argue about, you know, how they're going to compromise those two versions. We actually got the House to concur with the Senate amendments, which is very, very rare on anything, let alone a major piece of policy. And I remember going up to Representative Pabon at the end and being like, oh my God, we just passed this bill. It was so exciting. You know, let's close the session and go celebrate. And he was like, what do you mean? He's like, we absolutely have to go to conference committee. We have to go to conference committee. And I said, no, we don't. We're all good. And he's like, he didn't believe me. He's like, I'm going to go check with all the stakeholders. And I was like, for sure. Like, I don't want to have a problem. Like, let's make sure we get it done right. And he came back to me about a couple hours later and was like, I can't believe it. Like, you're right. We don't need to go to conference committee. Everyone's fine with it. Let's just pass the bill. So the bill passes, and
so cannabis brings people together is the moral of the story here.
Sure.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's bipartisan support. People from all sides of the issue agreed on how to deal with it.
Well, you know, you had a very, very unique situation with cannabis. Not passing something wasn't really an option, right?
Okay.
The Constitution said
you had to.
That the Department of Revenue was going to adopt regulations by July 1, 2013.
Right.
They had to do it.
That's how they eventually made it happen in California too, right?
They
said they had to do it.
They forced it. Yeah, we can get into a little bit of how California, but essentially you have a situation where the public forces the legislator's hand. And by forcing them to do something, you kind of force them to come together and pass something. And we got fantastic ideas from both sides of the aisle. We also got terrible ideas from both sides of the aisle. There were a lot of different things along the way, and maybe one day we'll do a future podcast where I'll tell some war stories about all of this stuff. But there were some really amazing policies. Senator Ulibarri, who is a former ACLU person, really did some amazing work around suitability requirements and things of that nature. So, you know, we're talking a lot of different people bringing different ideas to the table and, you know, helping to influence where the policy went.
So let's break right there. Chip Baker, I got Jordan Wellington here. This is The Real Dirt.
Who's got the herb?
Personal musical interlude here.
Who's got the herb? Who's got the herb?
Can't you hear it? You know, I'm a great musician. My bathroom, my head. All right. So we were talking about like how it all happened.
Yeah.
Right. We've had the history, the development, the legislation. One of the reasons I think Colorado's model was so successful is because it came through the legislative body and the legislative process. In California, it was a voter-sponsored initiative. People hate that. People love it. People hate it. Right. I have been really excited to see it happen here. And honestly, that's why I moved to Colorado, is because it was happening so quickly and it was happening here, where in California it was stalled. And it still hasn't quite happened there. And we're back. This is The Real Dirt with Chip Baker and Jordan Wellington. Today, we're talking about how the legal policies developed with California and Colorado cannabis, specifically Colorado. Jordan was a instrument in helping all of this happen on the legislative side. And we're talking about the rules.
Yeah. So once the pieces of legislation passed, those particular bills during the 2013 legislative session, everything had to go to rulemaking. It had to go for the, you know, nitty gritty details to be worked out.
So rulemakings, they're the back room. People get together and say, hey, I want this. I want this. There's no voting. There's no.
Correct. There's no voting. So
there's no voting. So we've gone through the legislative process. Now right. This is. I'm not saying a backroom deal, but it's a group of individuals that get together and debate the best way to do it.
Yeah. So, from a legal structure perspective, you have kind of three levels, and this works really well in cannabis for an example. So you have the constitutional level, and that's Amendment 64, right? It basically protects people's right to possess cannabis, says there will be licenses and licensed businesses, and then basically tells the government to go sort it out with some very high level you should regulate advertising type stuff. Then the statutes come in and provide, let's not even say the meat on the bones, that's really just the skeleton at that point. And they start adding in kind of, wait, you know, we're going to regulate things this way. These are the suitability requirements. These are what would disqualify you from getting a license, right?
Because if you felony here or if you... How do you get disqualified from a license?
It's criminal background stuff for the most part, and then residency requirements. Mm-hmm. So if you were to say, so child-resistant packaging is a great example, right? Amendment 64 doesn't mention child-resistant packaging. It just says protect minors. So legislature then takes that direction and says, okay, we're going to do child-resistant packaging. We're going to reference the federal standard, which is 16 CFR 1700.20, or the Poison Prevention Packaging Act.
Right, absolutely.
It was then the Marijuana Enforcement Division's job, the regulator's job in the rulemaking process to figure out what that exactly means, what would and wouldn't be considered sufficient for child-resistant packaging purposes, right? So we move into this rulemaking phase, and I think that, you know, how you describe it is very common. You find that it's a very lobbyist-driven process, and it's not normally as inclusive a process as something like a legislative process.
This is the most important process to some degree. The laws as they're passed can be vague, just like you said on the tamper-resistant packaging, right? This is how it actually happens. This is what's going on in California right now. They're deciding how the regulations are going to be put in place. This is also something that's ever-changing here in Colorado. And when we started all this in 2013, 14, it's different today.
The regulations have evolved. So there's been a lot of iterations. The first iteration, which was for the July 1 deadline that we mentioned earlier for finishing the administrative rules, was 64 pages, which was nice, Amendment 64. We had a little bit of synergy. Today, they're around 220, 230
because people
pages.
Develop problems over time. Ideas didn't work.
Exactly. And so, you know, I think that one of the great misnomers about what's gone on here is the Colorado model. People talk about it all the time. They refer to the Colorado model for cannabis. And there is this assumption that that is our regulatory structure. And it's not. The Colorado model actually has nothing to do with the words on the page. The folks involved will all tell you the same thing. It was the process by which we got there. Cannabis regulation is not cookie cutter, and it shouldn't be. It needs to be specifically designed to each unique environment, whether you're talking
state by state.
State by state, the U.S. Virgin Islands has unique issues. I've been working down there with their Chamber of Commerce. The U.S. Virgin Islands has unique issues in comparison to Jamaica, which has unique issues in comparison to Colorado, which Colorado has unique issues in comparison to California. And so instead of saying that the Colorado regulations themselves are the model, what we like to talk about is how we create policy here. And that is the working group model. So instead of kind of the backroom descriptions that you were given, the Marijuana Enforcement Division hosts working groups. There's actually several this week, the week that we're recording it, to deal with some of the changes in the law that came from this past legislative session. And basically, the Marijuana Enforcement Division, they're not town hall meetings. They invite particular participants who represent specific aspects of stakeholders that are critical to this issue. And then they have everyone argue about it. And the room goes around and they have usually some type of proposed rule. And people will debate that rule, how it should work, what the language should be. You know, most of the time, not is this or is this not a good policy unless there is wiggle room. A lot of times the Marijuana Enforcement Division has to do something and it becomes a question of how, not if.
Right, right.
And that's critical, right? And so you have these conversations about how to do it. And then, yes, you do have this a little bit more, you know, autocratic as opposed to democratic situation where people aren't voting. The folks at the Marijuana Enforcement Division do listen to everyone's arguments and then go back and write the rules as they think would work best.
Sure. Right.
But at the same time, it isn't this backroom process and it isn't this series of released drafts that have internal negotiations. There is a very public process. Any member of the public is welcome to attend working group meetings, and there is a time for public comment at the end of those meetings. And so the public is very, very engaged, and really the ideas and thoughts come from all over the place. And we've found that that is the best way to make policy because you don't know where the best ideas are coming from. We didn't know at the Marijuana Enforcement Division. After the legislature, I went to go work at the Marijuana Enforcement Division during the initial rulemaking, the first two sets of working groups after legalization. And we didn't know that we actually had PhDs with backgrounds in chemistry in the industry, people with, you know, masters in biosciences and things like that. But by having the working group process, we were able to pull these folks out of the woodwork and find people who could really participate. Professors from DU and CU on marketing were critical to the advertising regulations. Those folks may not have been in the process, but for me hunting them down and offering them seats on the working groups.
Right. So through Cultivate Colorado, we sell pesticides, fertilizers, potting soils, and the pesticide issue is one of the things that we come across constantly. On a monthly basis, the list of pesticides change. On a weekly basis, on a daily basis, sometimes a notice of a pesticide being out of regulation or in regulation. So this is exactly what you're talking about. As time goes, people realize certain rules or regulations don't work, and they actively change them. This is how we keep learning. This is how it keeps moving.
Yeah, the evolution.
The evolution of it all. Because we can't just write it one day and say, hey, cannabis is legal today. Go sell it.
Yeah.
Right? That doesn't work.
Doesn't work at all.
Right. Doesn't work at all.
And edibles are a great story about that. But let's talk about pesticides, because pesticides are fascinating. Pesticides and cannabis are actually one of the great misnomers from a legal and policy perspective. Most people believe that, you know, people are using bad pesticides on cannabis. When you read something in the Denver Post,
right.
Says there's a recall, people think, oh, my God, they're doing heinous, dangerous things. Because it says, you know, business X
unregistered,
banned pesticide on cannabis.
Unregulated pesticide.
Pesticides is essentially banking. That's one of the things that people don't realize. People understand, at least those in the industry understand, the banking issue, that the federal government regulates banking. Cannabis is illegal on a federal level, so you can't access banking, or there are banking issues with cannabis and legalized cannabis.
Right.
Well, the federal government regulates pesticides.
Right.
Not the states for the most part. California is kind of a weird exception. Let's leave them off to the side. But for the most part, pesticides are regulated at the federal level. What pesticide can go on what crop at what time and in what intervals is an EPA and FDA issue,
right.
Not a state
regulatory issue. A labeling issue. It has to go on the package. It has to be specific per crop, per pesticide, per application use.
Exactly. And those labels are approved by the EPA, not the Colorado Department of Agriculture. And so when there is a recall that says banned pesticide, that's not really what's happening for the most part. I mean, sometimes people maybe are doing bad things. But what they are doing is they are using pesticides that are commonly applied to many crops across the country.
All the food we eat.
But not specifically labeled for cannabis.
Right.
And so we don't have the science and data that shows cannabis uptake and retention levels due to specific chemicals.
Right. They haven't allowed the regulations. They haven't allowed the research.
And the studies have not been done.
Right. Because you can't legally say it's for cannabis, correct?
Exactly.
Right.
The EPA is now listening to something called 24C, special local needs permits, where they won't change the label, but they will say it's kind of like it is on the label in Colorado. But the only people that can do that are the manufacturers of the pesticide. And despite cannabis being, a great economic opportunity with lots of jobs and tax revenues coming in,
right,
it certainly is not wheat. And
yeah,
it certainly
it's
not is
industrial not industrial agriculture.
It's not. So it's not the
still a boutique crop.
It's a boutique crop. What the pesticide folks will say is there's the big eight, which is like corn and soy and all of that kind of stuff. That's going to move Monsanto, the people who own the patents on this, to do the research to get the labels changed.
Right.
Cannabis is just not enough of a market to begin with. So
absolutely. There's billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars in alfalfa, right? But they estimate the current legal cannabis industry at...
We had $1 billion in sales in Colorado
right.
in 2015.
Right.
We're not that.
On a world economy, it's still small.
Exactly.
To me and you, $1 billion is a lot. Right, right.
Quite a bit.
Right, don't.
Quite a bit.
That would set you and Mom and Bean up for a while.
It would set the family up quite well, for sure. And so, you know, what you have is this situation where people aren't, you know, the story out there, the common understanding, this idea that people are spraying banned pesticides. I mean, what people think is like, that's something that was banned by the federal government until No.
It's
the
harmful
stuff that's
or dangerous.
On hops
or,
and all of this stuff.
Yeah, right.
And we just need to do more science on. Can you spray this particular thing on cannabis or not? Right now, we don't know. And if you can spray it on cannabis, when in the cultivation cycle can you spray it? Because that's really the most important thing is if you apply a pesticide for the most part early enough, it will be out of the plant by the time it's ready for human consumption.
Right. But they just had to do the research to develop that. Right. And the research hasn't been allowed yet on cannabis for the pesticides.
And the question is when... Right. It's not just like how long are you going to harvest it? It's then what is it done? Right. Hops are treated very, very differently when you brew beer than drying and curing cannabis flowers.
Absolutely.
Right. So it's not even just the plant itself. It has to do with consumption methodologies, which complicate things in cannabis because we have not just consumption of raw flower by both smoking and vaporization, which are slightly different and somewhat similar. You've got inhalation studies.
Right.
You've got combustion points and all kinds of things to
work. Temperatures
about.
Change the chemical composition of almost everything.
Everything.
Right. Right?
But then you've got extraction. Right.
Right. Concentrates.
Oh, interesting. Are we talking about butane, CO2? Are we talking about butter? Are we talking about rosin?
Right.
Are we talking about water hash? And then what are you doing with that concentrate? Are you then smoking or vaporizing
it? Because it's not just concentrating THC or CBD. It also concentrates the other components as well.
Exactly. But how much is in there? Does an extraction method of CO2 or butane bring along residual pesticides in a way that water won't? And are you then
Nobody
smoking
knows
that?
It's just theoretical.
It's
right
all
theoretical.
They're questions that we don't have the answer to. Are you then making an edible out of it? Right, a whole nother question. And then all of a sudden, you're not smoking it. It's going through your gastrointestinal tract, an entirely different method of consumption.
Right.
And so these are questions that we don't have the answer to in cannabis. And so all the states that have legalized have permitted a very, 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 very small amount of the pesticides regularly commercially available in this country.
Right. It's all stuff for just general agriculture. Herbal extracts, botanical extracts.
Exactly.
Salts, maybe some potassium salts.
And so when you see this kind of stuff, when you see a banned pesticide, it's banned for cannabis, not banned in the United States. And it's not really banned for cannabis.
People think DDT when they think banned.
Exactly.
Right.
It's a bit of a misnomer. So, you know, the newspapers are doing their best to cover it. And it's not a question of blaming. It's a question of nuance. And nuance is really like the terrain where people who work on this from a policy perspective and the lawyers and the business owners understand. But the rest of the country, they don't need to know the nuance and the absolute weeds of the policy around cannabis and pesticides.
Right. They just want to smoke weed.
And they want it to be safe.
They want it to be safe. Absolutely.
And it's safer in the regulated market than it's ever been in the black market.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
Hopefully we will continue to move towards a space of greater safety because the federal government will legalize cannabis. There will be pesticides approved for cannabis once we have that data. And then you can start getting into what is and isn't organic, and you can start getting into organic labeling and all the kinds of things that we would expect from a commercial product produced in the United States.
Yeah, perfect, perfect. So you just brought up an excellent point, Jordan, about concentrates in cannabis and concentrates in edibles. People aren't aware that mostly they'll make a hashish or a concentrate of some sort, an extract of cannabis with THC and CBD, and then take that, dissolve it in some sort of butter or fat to put in the quote-unquote edible or ganja food, right? And this has been an underrated industry. It's becoming huge here in Colorado.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even going back, in Colorado, we consider even your traditional cannabis butter, you know, to be a concentrate. To concentrate it in a sense, because it's the most similar, right? I mean, what you were doing, you know, in your own kitchen when you were trying to make weed butter to make brownies 20 years ago, you're making your
concentrate.
Own, you're extracting cannabinoids from the cannabis itself,
right? Just to take the leaf of the cannabis and put it in butter
and then
to make ganja butter,
boil it,
right?
And then strain it out. I mean, in and of itself,
that's a concentrate.
That it is in a lot of ways, and from a regulatory perspective, it might as well be within the process. And so that is what we consider it to be. And then from there, you get to the edibles, right? And
I never really thought about it that way. That concentrates were edibles, not just that you put concentrates in edibles.
You put a concentrate in an edible so that you can eat it.
Sure.
Right? And you can activate concentrates so that you can eat them directly. And then it is an edible, right? An activated concentrate is an edible in a sense.
Right. You mean like the crystalline CBD or the clear product? The
crystalline
THC.
Well, it's all about
THC.
Decarboxylation.
Right. And you heat it up. Right?
So if you take any type of hash oil and you heat it to the point of decarboxylation but not combustion or vaporization, you have now made an edible. Now you can eat it.
Because your body can digest it.
Right.
Right, because a chemical change has gone through this deep.
Right. I'm not suggesting that that's something you should or shouldn't do. I'm simply saying that, like, it is in very much the same thing. And when you're eating an edible, you are consuming extracted cannabinoids in the same way that you are when you're vaporizing it. It's just you're taking it from the raw plant and you're consuming it either, you know, through inhalation or through digestion. It's just one or the other. And so, you know, those have become one of the most fervent grounds for regulation, one of the areas of most scrutiny by regulators, concentrates due to the fact that it really is some complex manufacturing.
It is.
And there are employee safety issues that must be addressed.
I never really thought about the employees. How are the employees at risk?
In the same way they would be in any other industry and in any other facility. There's fire codes and building codes and electrical codes.
Sure. Standard stuff.
Yeah. Right. And Colorado's regulations that even do pay specific attention to concentrate production are mostly nothing more than references to the fire codes and building codes. You know, I drafted 605 in the initial one that came out in 2013. And most of what it does is simply say that these businesses have to be compliant with the building code and the fire code and the electrical code.
Most of the requirements aren't unrealistic.
No, the question is where you classify it. That becomes what really matters. The fire code says that, you know, if you do this, that, or the other thing, then you have to have this kind of building.
Right, a fireproof or explosion-proof or
exactly
room.
And that generally has to deal with, you know, what type of things you have and regularly almost the amount of flammable materials that you have.
Sure. So we have the same.
At certain quantities, the more flammable material have, the more fire resistant.
So many gallons or so many pounds.
Do you need sprinkler systems?
Right.
Do you need blast
proof? Evacuation?
Spark proof, equipment. Do you need all the electrical equipment? All of that stuff is driven by the International Fire Code, the International Building Code, and the International Electrical Code, which are then adopted by different
localities. And cannabis farmers and extractors have never had to follow any of these codes. So it's become difficult for people to step into this new world, really.
Absolutely, especially when you've invested in a facility where you weren't required to. What my experience is that most businessmen will comply with whatever regulations that they have to operate. But what becomes most challenging is when you make your investment and then you have to readjust because the regulations change. So if you're not required to do something and then you are, that, you know, that period of reinvestment can be very challenging for businesses.
Right. Absolutely. They, numerous people were put out of the market on the early years, right? Not following the right regulations, or they weren't even following regulations. There weren't any regulations in place. They started business and then the regulations came. They weren't able to comply, or it was just too much money for them to comply.
Right. And that's edibles are such a good story behind that. Because those regulations have changed so much dramatically over time.
The quality of them changed so much. You know, several years ago, the dosing wasn't there. They had no idea how many milligrams were in there. And now it's heavily, you know, governed, so to speak.
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't here at the time, but I've heard stories like other people.
Chiba Chews. I don't know if we could say that name, but Chiba Chews, they used to say unpredictably strong was their logo, unpredictably strong.
In medical, you know, when things first came around, even under the first regulated system, there weren't potency caps or dosing restrictions. It was just, you know, they were very loosely regulated. There were some basic sanitary requirements.
Just like any other food.
No, actually, they weren't considered food. They were exempted from the definition of food and not given.
So not even made in commercial
food handling
kitchens.
Oversight and not handling in commercial kitchens. Denver came forward really as the first ones to try to push that they should be treated with normal food handling oversight. And we've seen, a lot of movement in that direction over the years. But they were not unregulated, but very loosely regulated. Over time, that's really changed. In 2012, you have Amendment 64 pass. And during the adoption of those, both the statutes and then the regulations that came after that we've talked about, there's been a lot of change in terms of what they've done with edibles. So first, they put a potency cap in retail of 100 milligrams. They required servings and said that your serving can be no more than 10 milligrams. And then they imposed mandatory testing. And those were just the first set of regulations that came down for edibles. What's been particularly challenging for edible manufacturers has been the continued evolution of the regulations. So it started there. Right. But then the next thing was the debates around not just serving size, but really overconsumption, intentional overconsumption, not accidental ingestion where someone doesn't mean to consume cannabis, but intending to consume cannabis, but unfortunately having too much. And so that really led to the debate about segmentation and the new set of regulations. We call it like kit-catting, where, you know, you can still define your own serving of up to 10 milligrams and you can still sell multi-serving edibles. Still capped at 100 on the retail market. But you have to be able to say how much is a particular segment. So if you're going to sell, let's say, a 100-milligram edible with 10-milligram servings, you need to have 10 easy separable parts. So I, as a consumer, can say, okay, snap this piece off 10 milligrams.
Right. And this has been really great for the industry, honestly. I've seen so much innovation associated with this. And now you can get 5-milligram dosing, 10-milligram dosing, 20-milligram dosing, individual like mints or individual caramels. You know, it's been great for the industry.
Absolutely. I think if you're given a problem, businesses can innovate, right? That's one of the great things about this country.
People bitch about regulations all the time, but they're often for health and human safety issues, just like this.
Yeah. I wish we had more data. You know, unfortunately, we don't have a ton of data about which particular regulation has resulted in what particular outcome.
Sure.
But we will, I mean, over time, hopefully social science researchers and we'll get better data behind public policy. Right now, it's a lot of, people trying to do their best and reacting to things that they see in the market. But that was really just the first step, right? So now there's all of this segmentation or kit-catting of products. And as you say, it certainly makes it easier for consumers. And then the next step was this marking and stamping debate, which was very interesting from last summer. And that was the idea where the child-resistant packaging was supposed to prevent accidental child ingestion.
But that's not enough.
But there were concerns about accidental ingestion by adults, products outside of their packaging, where people wouldn't be able to tell if that was cannabis.
Sure, this may have happened to my mother a few years ago.
Right, and it's a very disconcerting experience. I think if you want to consume cannabis, that's fine, but you should know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, now they label it clearly THC on the edible.
Right. And right. So there was a big debate in the legislature about this piece of legislation and then a huge debate in working groups about it, which were very, very interesting. And I think the data remains to be seen about the effectiveness of this and whether it's necessary. But, you know, right now we really have that laboratory of democracy phase that, you know, people always like to talk about, where you're going to have different states try different policies, and hopefully we'll be able to see what's effective. So now there are products that are considered impracticable to stamp and then practicable to stamp. And those that are practicable receive a diamond shape with a THC and an exclamation point, which you could read as either caution or enthusiasm. Right.
Like the Lucky's edibles. Those are an example of that.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. There are several that have them on the market already with this diamond shape and exclamation point on them. And so, you know, we'll see how effective that is of a policy, but that was another change that these businesses had to go to. And now we're reaching what should be almost funny this summer. The next debate, there was another piece of legislation passed, and it prohibits all edibles in the shapes of humans, animals, and fruit.
This is to keep it out of as candy, to keep it not looking like candy.
Yeah, it's a child resistant measure in theory to make things not attractive to children, or defining what might be attractive to children. At this point, the regulations have prohibited any shapes that are attractive to children, but it's very hard to define that in terms of what it means from a legal perspective to cite a business and fine a business.
You know, I'm not sure that I'm familiar with any candies that are in the shape of humans. What am I missing here?
Well, you know, you might have like some person shaped gummy bears and things like that, or not gummy bears.
I mean,
bears,
just
but
currently, I'm just wondering
humans,
like how they decided to put humans on this list.
I think what's interesting about that is first of all, humans are animals, so it's tautological.
Right. Okay. Great point.
But also, what we've really started to talk about, and there's some very conversations, are robots human shaped?
Okay.
Are androids human-shaped? Because they are technically human-shaped robots. So I think androids might be out. Robots that are very boxy and distinctive, you know, maybe they're in. Those are the conversations the Marijuana Enforcement Division is going to have this summer. You know, what about a hand or a foot? Is that human-shaped? It's not the shape of a whole human. It's the shape of a part of a human.
Correct. Right.
Fascinating. Animals, you know.
I'd have seven hand candies, please, and one foot.
Not human shaped.
Yeah, unhuman shaped animal parts,
right.
Please.
And then fruits are totally not allowed, but vegetables unmentioned. So is broccoli shaped gummies permissible?
And this is the whole: is a tomato a fruit or a vegetable?
Right.
There's
and now we have all kinds of problems. And then finally, brought up by someone that I know.
Because kids don't want to eat vegetables. This is the perfect thing, right?
I guess. I don't, you know, the internal debates on passing this statute I wasn't in on, but it's certainly an interesting way to look at it. I don't really think things should be shaped in a way that are attractive to children, but when you prohibit an animal shape or a fruit shape, it leads to all kinds of legal questions about, well, what does that mean? Because there are a group of individuals that are required to go around the state and find, cite, and stop businesses from doing things that are against a set of legal rules. And so now a group of regulatory enforcement officers are going to have to ensure that things aren't a specific shape, which means regulations around what a shape means have to be developed, which leads to, obviously, all of these kind of very interesting questions. My favorite so far has been, is a circle-shaped object that is both orange in color and flavor shaped like an orange, or does it require a stem and or leaf? So these are the kinds of esoteric questions that I don't think anyone ever forced a regulatory agency to ask.
Right.
But those questions are now going to be debated in working groups this summer.
It's going to create a square industry, obviously.
Yeah, very square. At the end of the day, hopefully this will lead to a better industry, a stronger industry, but it also leads to tremendous costs that are absorbed by businesses and product design and redesign, packaging design and redesign. And it's important to recognize that.
It's expensive and costly.
It is.
That's for sure.
It should be a very, you know, I mean, it's fun to make light of it, and it certainly is going to be amusing in a certain way. But, you know, there are costs that come along with all of this. Those costs are then borne by consumers. And hopefully what will come out of this is, you know, good policy. And I think everyone agrees and is on the same page that, you know, nobody wants cannabis products to be attractive to children. The producers certainly don't want it. And the rest of the stakeholders don't want it. It's just very complicated to define that. And the focus on cannabis has led to some really interesting conversations. They put alcohol in chocolate. They put vitamins in gummy form. Kids die from eating Tide packets. These are all important regulatory questions. We're just having some of the most industry ones.
How do we get there?
Most interesting ones, you know, in cannabis, because there's so much focus on how it's on this issue today. So we'll see.
It's all brand new.
Most certainly.
Well, let's break there again. It's The Real Dirt, Chip Baker, Jordan Wellington. How you doing over there, Jordan?
I'm fine, thank you. I'm
doing good, doing good. All right, where were we, Jordan? We were speaking of the edible industry.
Yeah, we were talking about the kind of evolution of the regulation industry. In Colorado.
Right, right. You know, it's not just Colorado anymore. It's Colorado, Oregon, Washington. They all have active legal sales. Nevada.
Alaska has adult use as well.
Adult sales, adult use.
No, I don't think they have businesses open yet, but they're coming.
They're on the way.
And the laws have passed.
Right. So it's coming. What, there's Ohio, right? Didn't they just pass a...
Ohio passed a bill, and there will be a ballot initiative, I believe, in Ohio. So there's a lot coming on the ballot in November. Everybody has to remember to vote in all states, but especially in states where it's on the ballot. Make sure you get all your friends to vote as well. There will be legalization on the ballot in California, Nevada, Arizona, Maine.
Adult use.
And Massachusetts. Adult use.
Not just medical. Adult use.
Adult use. As well as medical ballot initiatives in Missouri, Florida, Arkansas, Ohio, and possibly others. And I'm not sure if 100% of the ones I've listed have qualified for the ballot, but there are at least campaigns running in those states, and I believe most of them will. And quite a few of them have already qualified for the ballot. But again, that's you know, you can find all of that information from Marijuana Policy Project and other great groups like Drug Policy Alliance that are you know, really working to change all of these laws, and you should definitely donate money to them as well.
Yeah, good point. They only do the work for us when they can afford it, and it takes our contributions to make people like Marijuana Policy Project, Cannabis Action Network.
Absolutely. I mean, these organizations need help. They're fighting on multiple fronts. You know, and they're fighting for everyone's rights not to be a criminal, which matter a lot. So, you know, hopefully we will see those initiatives pass and regulation really start to be adopted. You know, we've seen a lot of growth in medical bills also passed by legislatures and markets opening up in other states. You know, you mentioned Nevada. Nevada has a functioning medical cannabis market with cultivators, manufacturers, testing labs, and dispensaries all operating. Multiple other states along on the East Coast. Massachusetts is very slow coming out, but it would be a really great, you know, hopefully close to operational East Coast outpost with legalization.
Right, Massachusetts is a huge cannabis consuming area for years.
Yeah, absolutely. Rhode Island, we've seen, you know, a lot of progress. Marijuana Policy Project has you know, really helped advance legislation there. Nothing's passed, but they've made a lot of progress. Marijuana Policy Project has also been working with, you know, all of our allies as well. Up in Vermont, you know, Andrew Livingston and I had an opportunity to go out there and work with some of the folks there, Matt Simon and some amazing people that are trying to, you know, pass legalization. And that they came close. Unfortunately, it didn't pass by, you know, a vote in the House. But, you know, that would have been the first state to legalize cannabis through the legislature, which would have been a, you know, huge progress as well. So, you know, we expect a lot of states to be moving forward. California, obviously a massive market. Everyone expects the Adult Use of Marijuana huge. Act to pass. And, you know, that really, you know, could really help change the landscape if Nevada changes. You know, a lot of people
haven't mentioned
Las Vegas.
Illinois.
Illinois has a medical cannabis market.
Medical cannabis. There you go.
You know, that's coming along. Arizona also has a medical cannabis market. New Mexico has a medical cannabis market that's also evolving.
Right. And important, just smaller. It's a smaller segment.
Smaller. What you see, and Andrew Livingston, to plug a future podcast, will, you know, be on The Real Dirt. And, you know, he really is an expert in all of these areas and can sure. explain, you know, the dynamics of this. But basically, you know, you see a lot of these medical markets controlled by limitations on doctors and limitations on conditions. And so you don't have a huge percent of the population consuming cannabis through the regulated market. You really see that population transition from the black market to the regulated market once you pass adult use. And so, you know, from a market perspective, you know, the numbers are just very different. California and a few states otherwise. But, you know, the details of that, I think, is really his domain.
Sure, absolutely. My point was this just spreading quickly. It's not just a few states any longer. It's almost everywhere, right? 26, 28 states or something are passing, have some type of active type of cannabis regulation.
Yeah, and it also depends on what you count, whether you consider CBD regulation and how you look right. at the CBD right. market. So, you know, it is one way or another growing at a very rapid pace. And it's very exciting because, you know, we're also seeing movement in other countries. Spain has had a lot of movement. They already have cannabis clubs there, but there's a move to pass regulations on cultivations. You know, Spain is actually Colorado, or at least Denver, Colorado's, you know, mirror opposite in a lot of ways. They have permitted public consumption. They have permitted social venues in a lot right. of ways. Sure. There's just no legal way for anyone to buy it or grow it or cure it or process it or anything.
Right.
Whereas
right.
in Denver, we have regulated cultivation, processing, manufacturing,
but not
testing and distribution. But God forbid anyone went to a concert and smoked a joint. That would be illegal.
Oh, no, that is really the biggest gap in the situation here is public consumption, because it is, I mean, it's something you do in a crowd, something you do with your friends, you know, and it's still like forced legally in private residence or private situations.
Yeah, and hopefully there will be actually something on the ballot as well in Denver this All November. Right. We're working on collecting signatures right now. There's a social use campaign, which would be a neighborhood pilot program that would people would get to vote in Denver whether we should try to regulate social consumption through approval of neighborhood associations and things of that nature.
Denver being the Amsterdam of the U.S. would be pretty incredible.
Well, you have to ask, you know, do you want it to look like Amsterdam? Well, should there be distribution? Here, there would just be bring your own cannabis, because the state law only allows licensees to sell cannabis in the state legally.
Sure. Good
and
point. Right, right.
It's illegal to consume cannabis on the property of a dispensary. So you could never have
it
until the state law changes. These would all be bring your own cannabis type situations. But really, you know, hopefully what would happen is a combination of new places and new businesses would be created. And then a certain number of limited existing businesses would also be able to, in specific areas under specific guidelines, permit the use of cannabis, you know, the right. Colorado Clean Indoor Air Act, for example, and things of that nature. So, you know, hopefully the idea is that it would be, you know, new businesses would be created, and then in certain limited businesses, it would be incorporated. One of the things I always feel like is, you know, when social use of cannabis is regulated in Colorado, I would much rather see it, you know, brought into the existing fabric of culture and society as opposed to,
absolutely, such
you know,
culture.
Separate venues created.
Yeah, it seems like if they have that, keep it with the dispensaries, or could change the law to some degree to where you could have like a consumption area associated with the dispensary. You've already gone through some of the things, like they checked your ID, they made sure that you're, you know, over 21, you've purchased it you know, from the facility. It just seems natural that you should be able to consume it there as well. You've already gone through their process.
Well, but if you look at liquor stores and bars, those are actually different licenses, right? So maybe, you know, that's another model to look at.
Just additional license, absolutely.
Well, you would have your liquor store license, which could be a dispensary, and you could allow, so you could allow consumption on the site of a dispensary. That would be one policy option. Another policy option is, you know, if you were to be able to sell it, you could maybe restrict it more like a bar, right? At a bar, you don't buy a whole bottle of tequila. You know, you buy it almost like one serving at a time, if you will.
Right.
So it's just...
And few bars also sell alcohol to go. I know in some states that is
right.
happens, but...
And that's all questions for regulation, right? And some states...
In time.
And some states permit it, and some, you know, localities permit it in other places. And those are the things that need to be worked out. And this initiative wouldn't address, you know, those kinds of things. Those would really be handled by the city council subsequent to the, you know, people saying, hey, we would like to have regulated venues.
Right. It has to come from the top down to so degree. The future of cannabis, public consumption, are there any other states that are talking about this in their current laws? I mean, Nevada seems like they'd have to think about this, just thinking about the mentality of it there. Yeah,
Alaska does.
Alaska.
Alaska has something coming online. We expect to see things in other states. I would assume Oregon, which has been very forward-thinking on policy, to come forward with some things. Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. It's not necessarily addressed in every initiative. There are the Adult Use of Marijuana Act in California will create kind of like tasting room almost style situations, I believe, under some permissive, but they also prohibit the consumption of alcohol and cannabis together in the in these places in the initiative. So, you know, those are still, you know, really interesting conversations that need to be had over time.
All right, Jordan, I'm going to ask you a difficult question here. Not too difficult, but I'm going to ask you to peer in your crystal ball. Pull your crystal ball out. You have it. So gaze.
Yeah, I got it. I'm looking. Ball.
5 years from now, what's happening in cannabis?
You know, I would hope to see legalization at the federal level. You know, that most likely won't mean that cannabis is legal in every state across the country. That might take some time longer than that. But I would expect to see movement where the federal government, you know, permits states to regulate cannabis on some level. You know, hopefully descheduling, you know, or at least schedule three or lower. But preferably, you know, the descheduling of cannabis. We'll see a lot of movement around medical research, I believe. CBDs, but not just CBD, other cannabinoids as well. And so, you know, hopefully we'll see lots and lots of development and fervent growth in those areas. I think that we'll start to see a lot of development in terms of extraction techniques and isolation of different, you know, components of the plant. You know, there's a lot of interesting things going on around terpenes and things of that nature. You know, hemp, industrial hemp, a huge potential area of
all over the U.S., right?
You know, and then we'll see, you know, how the interstate markets start to develop. You know, can cannabis grown in different states be shipped to other states? Right now, every state's an isolated market. You know, 5 years from now, that might be the time where people start talking about interstate. You know, it might come sooner, it might come later. And eventually, hopefully, you know, evolution on the international level, changing of international treaties and things like that. You know, we're already seeing movement in Jamaica and Costa Rica.
Jamaican herb.
You know, yeah, well, you know, there's a lot of movement. There's a cannabis licensing authority down there. You know, the Council on Responsible Cannabis Regulation just helped, you know, put together a tour for the cannabis licensing authority down there. And we got to meet with them at our office. And they're dealing with
import herb come back.
Well, they were just regulators and policymakers. Sure. you know, there was, you know, some really interesting conversations, you know, including about, you know, issues around black markets and exportation, and they have a medical cannabis law. So there's a lot of evolution that I think we'll see on the international side as well. You know, Spain seems to be the first domino in Europe to fall, and then what will come thereafter.
Your prediction, to summarize, we hope to see the scheduling change in 5 years, hopefully to three.
A scheduling change at the federal level, increased growth, at least of medical and hopefully adult use on the state level. And then, you know, hopefully
CBD.
Development on the CBD, absolutely medical and pharmaceutical research. you know, will come along. Hemp, industrialization of hemp, you know, hempcrete, plastics, all of these new commodities that people are trying to produce with hemp.
I think hempcrete's one of the best things for hemp because it's a locally produced commodity. They can grow the hemp in the area. They're producing hemp concrete in the same areas. Concrete has to be made locally. It can't be shipped, right? It's a perfect union, right? Hempcrete is a lighter product. It's engineered structurally just as stronger, right? I really see huge movement with hempcrete and animal feeds associated with hemp. Silage type products, fermented type products for animal feed. I think both of those are incredible avenues for hemp to come in the future for sure.
We probably don't really even know at this point.
We don't. So much innovation's coming.
What the newest thing is going to come. So right. 5 years from now, hopefully we see a lot of growth. I see no reason to be pessimistic, but you know.
Yeah, 5 years, I'm going to call you up and I'll be like, dude, here, let's remember when we did this? Listen to this. Your predictions came true.
Ooh, Nostra Wellington.
Awesome. Great, man. Hey, I'm wondering, you know, an interesting thing I ask everybody is the terminology. Like cannabis industry is developing its own terminology. And most of the people I talk to come from a direct, either touching the plant or touching the equipment. They're hydroponic equipment producers, indoor horticultural equipment producers, ganja growers. Do you guys have any special terminology that the general world might not know about in talking or dealing with cannabis, the law, regulations?
We tend to really deal with all of the different types of people that touch the plant. So we end up with that same kind of industry terminology, I guess, that other people do. You know, I never referred to things as like flower and trim and extract and like specific types of extract before I got really involved in the industry because, you know, from a consumer perspective, it was irrelevant. You know, it was all just pot.
So the industry terms have moved over to you.
Oh,
cuttings, babies, trim.
You need a common language.
Sure.
Both. I mean, you need it for contracts. I don't deal with that stuff, but you need it for all the different, the policy areas, right? You need to understand it. There's an average market rate in Colorado. The excise tax, the wholesale tax on production on cannabis is determined by an average market rate because there's so many vertically integrated businesses that you don't have arm's length transactions at all times. And so there's this, for every pound of cannabis that moves, you have to pay 15% of this determined average market rate.
Sure, right. And every 6 months it's
changes.
Changes.
But the difference between bud and trim, those are huge on the market.
Absolutely, right.
So there are two different rates. So what is bud and what is trim are, you know, a huge, huge important conversation that policymakers and regulators need to understand now where, you know, 3 years ago, your average, you know, tax guy in the Department of Revenue didn't need to know the difference.
It was all weed.
Right. Well, it wasn't taxed,
bud,
you know.
Right.
Right. It wasn't taxed in that way. And now they need to know. And there's a huge commercial difference between the two. So, you know, those regulations have to be drafted appropriately because you can't have trim being taxed at $1,800 a pound, right?
Yeah, there you
go. Right. It's like $300 a pound.
Cannabis culture, we're coming into it. We're changing the world.
It's being brought into the light.
It is being brought in the light. Wow, it's been an awesome conversation, Jordan. I'm sure it's raised several questions with me today on future podcast episodes. During the break, we've had a couple conversations. Enjoyed the conversation. Thanks, and I hope you come back.
It was great being here.
All right, this is The Real Dirt. Chip Baker, Jordan Wellington. Let's roll another one out. This has been The Real Dirt with Chip Baker. I'd like to thank all of our guests for participating in this fun project. Thanks for sharing your stories and bringing your weed. Also, thanks to Cultivate Colorado, providing all of your hydroponic and horticultural equipment needs throughout Denver and the surrounding galaxies. This has been The Real Dirt of Smoking Roaches production. Hell yeah. Let me give a shout out to my homeboys and girls. That'd be Lisa, Willow, David, Chris. Thanks, y'all, for putting it together today. Also want to thank all my guests. Man, without you, it couldn't be possible. Stay dirty, my friends.